This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
From the heart of London, this is Resonance 104.4 FM.
Would you believe cosmic dust reveals a hidden history of past sea ice? That it predicts a crash of Arctic Ocean life? That warming air, not warmer seas, drives sea ice loss? We explore stories of cosmic dust with lead author of a new paper, Dr. Frank Pavia from the University of Washington. Frank is an isotope geochemist with new tools to explore past and present climate. From Washington State, Frank Pavia, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for the introduction.
Well, you and your colleagues just published Cosmic Dust Reveals Dynamic Shifts in Central Arctic Sea Ice Coverage Over the Past 30,000 Years. It's a big new view, so we need to start with a couple of basics. What is cosmic dust?
Yeah, so cosmic dust means something different to, say, an astrophysicist than it does to, a climate scientist or a geochemist. So cosmic dust, as, you know, we apply it here, we're talking about stuff that initially forms as debris from collisions between solar system bodies, things like comets and asteroids. And that generates much smaller, right, sizes of grains in the solar system. Now, finer grained materials in the solar system go into orbit around the sun, just like everything else. But there's drag on them, and that causes them to lose angular momentum and start spiraling in towards the sun. And as that happens, these cosmic dust grains get bombarded with the solar wind. And the solar wind, right, the sun is doing fusion. It's turning hydrogen into helium. The solar wind is extremely enriched relative to Earth materials in a rare isotope of helium, helium-3. And so that solar wind embeds this rare helium isotope signature into these cosmic dust grains as they spiral towards the sun. Now, on their transit, they can intersect Earth, right, and pass through Earth's atmosphere. As they pass through Earth's atmosphere, the biggest of these grains get heated more than the smallest of these grains. And the big grains will lose and degas their helium. And only the smallest of these cosmic dust grains, we're talking about things that are 10 to 20 microns in diameter or so, retain their rare helium signature. And then, as they've passed through the atmosphere and retained their chemical signature of this rare helium, they blanket Earth's surface, and they blanket Earth's surface at a constant rate in space and time. And so we're using this principle that there is this constant rain of cosmic dust to Earth's surface in space and time over the past few hundred thousand years as a tool that we can use to try and study the way that the Earth and its oceans change in the past.
So it's important to note here that the helium-3 variety or isotope that you're looking at is only extraterrestrial. It wouldn't be found on Earth. It has to come from space. And what is the second element featured in your study, thorium-230? Why choose that?
Yeah, great question. So this is near and dear to my heart. I've spent most of my young career so far measuring decay products of uranium in the natural environment. So thorium-230 is an isotope that we're using as a benchmark to tell us how much cosmic dust-derived helium-3 we expect in our sediments. And just like helium-3, we're taking advantage of this property of thorium-230 that it rains down to the seafloor at a constant rate in space and time. So helium-3 is coming in from outer space and passing through Earth's atmosphere. Thorium-230 has a cycle that is completely contained within the water itself. So ocean water has about 3 parts per billion or so of uranium in it, right? That's completely natural. Uranium is extremely soluble in seawater, and so it's more or less evenly distributed throughout the entire ocean at a constant concentration. Now, that uranium will undergo radioactive decay, and the isotope uranium-234 radioactive decays into thorium-230. So because uranium is at a constant concentration in the ocean, this production of thorium-230 is happening at roughly the same rate everywhere in seawater. Now, unlike uranium, thorium is extremely insoluble in seawater. And so when you produce thorium-230 by radioactive decay, it sticks to particles in the ocean, which carry it downward towards the seafloor. And it's so sticky to these particles, it's so insoluble, that it's really hard to redistribute thorium across, you know, different spatial scales. And so the result is that all of the thorium produced by uranium decay in one place gets buried locally at the same place. And since we know how much uranium is in the seawater, and we know the depth of the ocean at a given location where we're measuring sediments, we know, right, how much thorium-230 is getting buried at the seafloor at that location. And, right, the key here is that because we know how much thorium-230 is getting buried at the seafloor at a given location, and we know what the input rate to Earth's surface of extraterrestrial helium-3 is in space and time, we can use thorium-230 to give us a prediction of how much helium-3 is supposed to be there. And then if we measure helium-3 and we see a deficit or enrichment in helium-3 relative to how much is supposed to be there, we can interpret that in terms of changing helium supply mediated by ice coverage at the sea surface.
Right. The helium can't get to the bottom because it's interrupted by the sea ice. So where did your seabed samples come from and how are they analyzed?
Yeah, so the seabed samples come from three sites in the Arctic Ocean, primarily in the central Arctic, and then bleeding over towards the Pacific side in the western Arctic. Right, these sediments were collected in an expedition in 1994, so long before I was a practicing scientist, or even in elementary school for that matter. And they were collected on an expedition that was actually the first major U.S. research expedition to reach the North Pole. And these sediments were collected and then stored for, you know, over 30 years by the U.S. Geological Survey. And they've turned out to be a treasure trove of really interesting information about Earth's climate over these past 30,000 years or so. And, right, there's been three or four new papers that have come out using these sediments as new analytical techniques have emerged over the past 5 to 6 years, right? That now we can go back to the sort of gold mine of sediments that were collected over 30 years ago and apply these new techniques to. So, right, I think the second question here was, what did we do to analyze our samples for thorium-230 and helium-3? So these cores had been subsampled already at about 1 centimeter increments. And so we got a whole series of 1 centimeter increment sediment samples to measure for both thorium-230 and helium-3. To measure thorium-230, we completely dissolved the sediments in a series of strong acids. And we take that dissolved sediment and pass it through a series of anion exchange chromatography columns. And the goal of this is to isolate just the thorium and uranium from everything else that's present in the sample, all the different elements. And once we've isolated that uranium and thorium, we measure it using plasma mass spectrometer that we can use to separate different isotopes by their mass to charge ratio and detect how much is present in a sample. To measure helium-3, we take a separate small amount of that same piece of sediment. We leach it in dilute acetic acid, right, the same stuff as vinegar, essentially, to get rid of any calcium carbonate that might be in the sample. And then we dry it, and we pack it into little foil balls. And once we've got those little foil balls with, you know, 50 to 75 milligrams or so of sediment in them, we drop them into a furnace that's held under vacuum. And once this is in the furnace, we heat the furnace up to something like 1300 degrees C. And all of the gas that's present in that sample then degasses right as you melt the sample. We take that gas through a vacuum line where we react out reactive gases like CO2, like nitrogen, and with the goal of leaving ourselves with just noble gases. And once we've got just these noble unreactive gases left, we freeze them down onto a cold trap held at something like 8 Kelvin with liquid helium, and that freezes all the noble gases down onto it, and then slowly raise the temperature. And as we raise the temperature of this cold trap to something like 20 Kelvin, we release helium off of the trap but keep all the other noble gases on. And once we've got that helium back in the gas phase, we then ionize it and bend it around a magnet to detect the helium ions by mass spectrometry as well.
My God, you're making me laugh. You know, once you get through these steps, it's not something we're going to do in our kitchen. And it's amazing anybody could put together those chain of events to get the results that you did. Now, I presume the Central Arctic was completely frozen over during the last big glacial age at the maximum time. And I looked it up, and it said there was about 29 meters of ice in the Central Arctic, maybe 85 feet. And the theory was, starting about 1970, that sea ice kind of spread out from the central hub of thick ice. But your paper suggests maybe not.
Yeah, so this is interesting. There's been a little bit of a debate, both like recently and during the 1970s, about the sort of flavor of ice that covers the Arctic Ocean during glacial periods. And the essential question at hand is this ice covering the Arctic sea ice? That is, does it form on top of the ocean and then get transported around on top of the ocean? Or does it represent flowing ice from land that's grounded underwater that forms something like floating ice shelves or floating ice caps? I think that you're referring to this paper by Mercer in 1970 that argued potentially for these ice shelves. And then there is a follow-up paper that was published in 1975 by Wally Broker that argued for the presence of floating ice caps as well. And right, the reason why paleoclimate folks got sort of interested in this question is they were trying to figure out sea level rise, or sea level fall rather, during glacial periods, and to try and reconcile how the oxygen isotope ratio that they measured in both marine sediments and in ice cores could balance, right, via changes in both ocean temperature and continental ice. And the goal of this Broker paper in 1975 was to try and reconcile all of these with the presence of an ice cap in the Arctic that didn't really contribute anything to sea level change, but could change the oxygen isotope ratio balance of seawater and polar ice. I think more recently, right, that 29-meter number that you mentioned came from a climate modeling study that was attempting to model sea ice in the Arctic during glacial times. And, right, I think the evidence now points more closely to, at least during the last ice age, there being something more like sea ice than, you know, grounded terrestrial ice or floating ice shelves. Though there was a paper in 2021 by Walter Geibert that argued that during a previous glacial period, there was a thick ice shelf that covered the entirety of the Arctic, and that ice shelf was accompanied by a freshening of almost the entire Arctic, which was a really fascinating and somewhat controversial paper that put out a lot of hypotheses to be tested by future work.
So according to the records indicated by the presence or absence of cosmic dust, when did sea ice start to retreat in the Arctic after the last glacial maximum?
Yeah, so the sea ice retreat really sort of commenced something about 15,000 years ago. And this gets into some issues with absolute dating versus relative dating in past climate studies. So developing chronologies of marine sediment records in the Arctic is pretty tricky, in part because sedimentation histories are complex, and in part because radiocarbon, the sort of classic tool that you use to generate age versus depth relationships, in marine sediments is somewhat more complicated in the Arctic. And so we have generated radiocarbon records that we use to develop these age depth models in our cores, but there's some uncertainty in the absolute ages of these cores, such that, right, delineating between something like 15,000 years ago and something like 13,000 years ago is a little bit trickier than if you were working with a sediment core, say, in the equatorial Pacific. But we can assess relative timing, that is, the timing of patterns that are discovered from analyses made in these same sediment cores that we analyze, a little bit more closely. And in particular, this is important for timing as we consider the changes in sea ice relative to large-scale changes in water inputs to the Arctic, mediated by the opening of the Bering Land Bridge, right, which was present as sea level was much lower during a glacial period in the Arctic roughly 11,000 years ago or so. And what we saw was that the decline that we saw during the deglaciation in sea ice coverage preceded the opening of the Bering Land Bridge and the opening of the Bering Strait for Pacific waters to get into the Arctic. And we were able to use that, right, because my colleague and the second author of this paper, Jesse Farmer, assessed the timing of the Bering Land Bridge opening and closing using nitrogen isotope measurements from these very same sediment samples where we made our sea ice reconstruction. And so even if we have some uncertainty on our absolute timing of our sediment records, our sediment depth in any given core, right, preserves relative time going from older to younger, going from the bottom to the top of the core. Does that make sense?
It does, but I'm still left with the question, how does that tell us a warmer atmosphere, not warmer seas, drove seasonal change to the sea ice in polar waters?
Yeah, great question. So, right, this allows us to eliminate one possible source of warmer waters to the Arctic in order to melt back glacial-style sea ice, right? And that's warm waters from the Pacific. So we got to have something else bringing heat in. And so our options remaining are the atmosphere and Atlantic waters, right, exchanging with the Arctic. And we don't actually conclusively rule out the Atlantic waters as a possible heat delivery mechanism, but we make some qualitative assessments based on the timing, right, of when these things change. But also, right, the relationship between the timing of reduced sea ice conditions with rising summer insolation, right, deduced from changes in Earth's orbit, warmer temperatures in Greenland ice cores during a similar time frame, and a limited set of records. There's really sort of one or two records out there that have tried to assess exchange of water between the Atlantic and the Arctic back through the same time interval. And there's really one paper that's sort of standing out in my mind about this, and that paper essentially found that there was minimal changes in Atlantic-Arctic exchange of water across the last 30,000 years, right? And so if that's the case, that sort of leads us back towards, well, then atmospheric heat delivery is a more likely candidate for, right, the melting back of sea ice. And in the modern ocean, right, sea ice forms at the base and it melts at the surface, right? But I would be hesitant to say that that book is closed. And I think that, right, starting, you know, now that we have this record of how sea ice has changed over the last 30,000 years, it gives us an opportunity to really dig in and hash out what the mechanisms of these changes were in more detail.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. Alex is talking with Dr. Frank Pavia about cosmic dust, sea ice, and life in a future Arctic Ocean.
Several papers suggest continued warming will lead to a boom of plankton and then nutrient starvation in the Arctic Ocean. Your paper adds some confirmation to that. Tell us about the process here.
Yeah, so there's sort of two ways that sea ice change can affect phytoplankton at the surface of the Arctic Ocean. And they both involve an increase in the fractional consumption of available nutrients at the sea surface. And this is a little bit of a tricky concept, right? Because if you've got a fractional change in nutrient utilization, you can either change the numerator or the denominator, which is to say that to more completely consume nutrients, you can either have phytoplankton grow more to consume more nutrients, or, right, you can change the denominator, and for a given amount of phytoplankton growth, you can decrease the inventory of available nutrients to phytoplankton. Okay, so sea ice decline gives two sorts of ways to modulate this. One is that sea ice inhibits light from getting to the surface of the ocean. And in this, and right, phytoplankton need light to be able to photosynthesize and grow and use nutrients. So as you melt back sea ice, you allow light in and you can stimulate phytoplankton growth, productivity, and increase the utilization of nutrients at the sea surface. But there's also a physical effect on water stability that comes from melting sea ice. So the ocean is stratified by its density, and fresh waters are less dense than salty waters. And as you melt back sea ice, you put in fresh water to the surface of the ocean, and that stratifies the water, and it limits the depth over which the phytoplankton might be able to grow. And so this is the mechanism by which you decrease the inventory of available nutrients, and you can increase your fractional nutrient utilization by phytoplankton without changing the total amount of productivity or by even shrinking the total amount of phytoplankton productivity. And so, right, what we found in our study was that there's really tight coupling of Arctic sea ice coverage with the fractional degree of nutrient utilization at the sea surface. But, right, we aren't able to decipher whether or not that's modulated by the physical mechanism or the biological mechanism. And so this is another example of a place where, now that we've seen this fundamental relationship, it's time to go in and start developing an understanding of what the mechanisms are behind it that we'll be able to use to sort of project our results to understand future change more directly.
Frank Pavia, previously you co-authored several papers on the dust of micronutrients that feed plankton. Geoengineering people want to use iron supplements to stimulate plankton blooms as a carbon reduction method. They want to know all about this. But how does dust move across the vast reaches of the Pacific Ocean?
Oh, yeah, great question. So, like, in a similar manner to cosmic dust being very fine-grained as it passes through Earth's atmosphere, by the time you get dust out to the middle of the Pacific Ocean, all that's left is the most fine-grained, the smallest dust grains that are around. But it's the atmospheric circulation. It's the patterns of wind at Earth's surface that carry entrained dust from the continents all the way out to the center of the Pacific. So as far away as you can get from land, you have the atmosphere with its winds carrying dust that was entrained from land. And you have to have some small amount of dust that doesn't get deposited during earlier rainout events over the history of that air parcel that then gets rained out as that air parcel continues out over the Pacific. Now, the places where I was working on this kind of stuff in the middle of the South Pacific Gyre, essentially as far away from land as you can get anywhere on Earth, right, have the lowest amount of dust that reaches the ocean anywhere in the world's oceans, right? So these are end members in terms of how little dust they get, which is a really interesting place to then go study because you want to know how ecosystems are primed to, right, having very minimal micronutrient inputs from dust.
Can we say with your recent new work that you found a new kind of clock showing the life of sea ice going back 30,000 years? And is there a limit? Could this method go back much further in time?
Yeah, so we have a little bit of a clock here. We're not able yet to say something directly about, say, sea ice formation rates or sea ice melting rates. And I think that would be really powerful if we were able to do that as we continue our work. There is a limit in terms of time of how far back we can push this specific method. It's based on two things. But the major one is that thorium-230, the sort of index tool that we use to tell us how much extraterrestrial dust or helium-3 is supposed to be in our samples. Thorium-230 is radioactive, and it has a half-life of about 75,000 years. So when we measure sedimentary records of thorium-230, we use the age of the sediments to correct thorium-230 for post-depositional decay to get back to what was the original concentration of it at the time of deposition. But as more and more thorium-230 half-lives elapse, our ability to do that goes away or gets really hard. And so you're sort of limited in your thorium-230 clock to something like 300 to 500,000 years. The second potential issue is that the constancy of the input of extraterrestrial helium-3 or cosmic dust has only really been conclusively established over the last 500,000 years or so. So you'd have to be making an assumption, or people would have to find clever ways to investigate the constancy of the cosmic dust flux further back in time before, right, you would start worrying about attributing possibly changes in helium-3 deposition to changes in helium-3 input from space or other processes rather than uniquely to sea ice coverage changes.
It's amazing. We picture Earth floating along through black, empty space, the void, but in fact, space is dirty. Tons of stardust, if you will, lands here every day. We never see it. Frank, how did you end up chasing dust?
Oh, yeah, cosmic dust. So I ended up starting working on cosmic dust when I was a PhD student at Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory, which is part of Columbia University. And most of my work at the time was focused on this thorium-230 tool. And we were really interested in prodding a little bit how thorium-230 worked as a sedimentation tracer, both in seawater, in terms of its seawater chemistry, and in surface sediments. And we started using the combination of cosmic dust, helium-3, and thorium-230 in these South Pacific sediments to test the assumptions of how these two proxies for sediment accumulation worked. And so I had some history of working with the combination of helium-3 and thorium-230, but the history was for completely different applications, right? That was more the study of how does sedimentation work in these environments in the South Pacific where sedimentation rates are really, really, really low. And sea ice study was initiated during my postdoc, which I was doing at Caltech. And it was sort of early 2021, and it was not long after, you know, COVID shut down, and we were back into our labs for the first time in a while. And I was sort of a hungry postdoc looking for cool scientific projects to work on. And I saw this paper had come out. I mentioned this paper earlier. It was the one that argued for the presence of a floating ice shelf in the Arctic during a previous glaciation. And this paper came out in 2021, and it used thorium-230 as a piece of evidence. And so I was already sort of like onto this paper as something that I was interested in. And I had worked on helium-3 and thorium-230 in concert before. And I started wondering whether or not helium-3 might be a way that you could tell if there was complete ice coverage at a given site in time because its input would be restricted by the coverage of that ice, right? So it was knowing something about how cosmic dust and helium-3 worked and seeing a piece of, right, scientific literature that seemingly asked for the application of helium-3 that then sort of set me off to the races. And I got in touch with Jesse Farmer, who's the second author of the paper that we just published. And Jesse and I had done our PhDs together at Lamont Doherty, and Jesse had worked extensively on Arctic paleoclimate at that point. So I said, Jesse, have you read this paper? And indeed he had. And I asked him whether he thought trying to measure helium-3 as a ice proxy via its blockage was a good idea. And Jesse thought it was worth a shot, and so he had some sediment samples that he had previously worked on, which ended up being the samples that constituted this paper, and he sent them over to Caltech, where I was. And I was not at the time working in the lab where the helium measurements got made at Caltech. I was working in a different lab. But I had become friends with the lab manager, Jonathan Trefcorn, in the helium lab. Jonathan is a co-author on this paper as well. And I had these sediments, and I sort of started talking to Jonathan about, well, you know, do you think there's a way that we could try and sneak in some pilot samples to see if there's a interesting thing here? And I picked a little bit of a fortuitous time to be able to try and, you know, make some opportunistic measurements. The PI of the helium lab at Caltech, Ken Farley, who's also a co-author on this paper, at the time was the chief scientist of the Mars rover that had just landed. And so he was busy with that, and he was still around trying to run his lab, but he was pretty happy for someone with a little bit of background to be using his instrumentation to make measurements. And so it was really a huge confluence of people who had to sort of come together and all agree that it was worth giving this slightly crazy idea a shot to be able to get there. And it became apparent really after the first set of maybe 20 measurements of helium that we made that included one of the cores that ended up in the paper, that included samples from the Holocene, right, so maybe 5,000 years ago, and samples from the last glacial maximum, so about 20,000 years ago. And it became apparent after that first set of data came back that indeed there was a really large signal of helium-3 deficit during the last glacial maximum. And that sort of just set us off to the races that, okay, indeed, this idea is borne out in the data. Let's go, right, really tackle this problem of Arctic ice coverage and what its climate controls are over this interval.
We'll have to wrap it up there. We're running out of time, but I think that's a beautiful example of how science can and should work. From the University of Washington College of Environment, we've been speaking with geochemist Frank Pavia. We are discussing the November 2025 paper, Cosmic Dust Record Reveals Arctic Ice Field Varied with Atmospheric Warming, Not Ocean Heat. Find links to all the science we just talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Frank, thank you for explaining this hidden record of climate change.
Thank you so much, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Join your listener-supported radio station at resonancefm.com.
The Normalization of Almost Everything. The article is from Rachit Dubé, assistant professor at UCLA. Rachit is a computational cognitive scientist analyzing how minds work. He published a series of papers about public apathy towards climate action despite harrowing extreme weather. He just won a 2025 Nomus and Science Young Explorer Award for his novel groundbreaking work. From California, Rachit Dubé, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
What is a computational cognitive scientist?
Maybe I can explain what a cognitive scientist is first. So a cognitive scientist looks at understanding the human mind, the structure of the human mind, and why we do the things that we do, and what gives rise to the thing called the mind. So cognitive science is a very interdisciplinary field. It combines insights from philosophy, linguistics, psychology, computer science, and anthropology, among many other disciplines as well. A computational cognitive scientist looks at the same questions, very similar questions about cognition, about why our minds act the way they do, why we take certain decisions through the lens of computer science. So for me, as a computational cognitive scientist, I use methods from computer science are a useful tool and an analogy as to how our minds could work. Because if you think it this way, you know, for a computer, there is, you know, the way we interact with a computer and the way the computer works is that there is an input, right? Like you type something on your keyboard, you use your mouse, you input something into a computer. It's a black box system, which we know a little bit something about, and it outputs an output, right? You type something and it outputs something out to you. And that's just the way, like, I think my mind also works. There's an input where we hear something, where we see something, and then we output something. It can be an emotion, it can be a behavior, it can be in terms of language. So that's why I think computer science and cognitive science historically have had a deep connection, because there's a lot of analogies and parallels that can be drawn from understanding the mind to understand and build better computers, And by building better computers, we can better understand the foundations of the human mind.
While working on your computer science doctorate at Princeton, you switched towards climate-oriented research. Why was that?
So when I began my PhD, I was interested in the computational foundations of the human mind and computational foundations of intelligence in general. What is it that makes any species intelligent, and particularly human minds, so remarkably intelligent? I started my career studying this very aspect of how we are able to learn so quickly from such little information, how we are able to explore the world, and how our human minds draw motivation to pursue long-term hard problems. So that's a lot of my early research looked at. In the middle of my PhD, for better or worse, I ended up coming across the IPCC report back in 2019, which was just newly released, and I, out of curiosity, ended up looking at it. And I've always been environmentally conscious, but climate change was never the dominant factor in my mind. Looking at the report, and I spent the next couple of months actually just reading. So that report was very shocking for me to read, because for me it was just, well, in many regards it was very alarming. Like, this is the state of the world, this is what the future projections look like, and this is what's actually happening, and the extent as to which human-caused climate change is already causing a lot of problems around the world, and it's projected to cause more and more problems. And then the next couple of months, I ended up reading more papers about climate change and biodiversity loss and extinction crises, the sixth extinction event that's undergoing. And to me, that was very alarming and very problematic. And I spent a lot of time thinking about, what should I do about this? And I was obviously very lost about it. I felt maybe, you know, it's fundamentally a very political problem. It's fundamentally a very policy-oriented problem. And I was feeling lost, obviously, with training in basic computer science and basic cognitive science as to what my work could do anything about it. And I was contemplating maybe I should be quitting my PhD program, maybe I should be going into a hedge fund and doing political lobbying, or maybe I need to work in the government, and that's something I should be working towards. At that time, I was, again, very lucky doing my PhD. I was very happy with the university I was at. I ended up taking up certain classes in from the policy department and politics department, and I took classes in climate law, international policy, in international climate policy. And in taking those classes, and one of the classes was actually taught by one of the IPCC lead authors. So in taking those classes, it was also quite striking to me that we are failing. One of the main problems with climate change is not the lack of technology or the development of technology or lack of good solutions. It is fundamentally a human behavior problem, because we are lacking the political will and societal will to act on climate change. So that led me back to the drawing board to think about that there is a pressing need for cognitive psychology and psychology to be part of climate policy making, to be part of climate change research, to improve the climate change communication, to build better climate policies. That's middle of my PhD. I decided that, you know, I want to reshift my focus into thinking about the problem of climate change through the lens of cognitive science in order to deepen an understanding of why we are not acting on climate change the way we should be, and how can we design policies and talk about climate change in a way that resonates with the larger swaths of public.
Scientists recognize normalization. They call it shifting baseline syndrome, but they could not explain why it happens. Can you get us any closer to knowing why?
So maybe I can explain what shifting baselines first means, right? So shifting baseline is when something that is seemingly terrible becomes the new normal. So shifting baselines happens over a period of time. Imagine this, that 50 years ago, if I was to magically be transported to certain parts of California, I would see thriving biodiversity. I would see a huge amount of different kinds of birds. I would see large swaths of different plantations and everything like that, and that would be very beautiful for me. But now, if I go back to my backyard, it will still be very interesting and nice for me. But the transition that has happened in the 50 years has been very, very big. The amount of biodiversity that we have lost has been very, very big, right? What shifting baselines is saying that this change has happened slowly in our perception. It has happened in a way that it has moved away from our own perception. It has become background noise. That's the basis of shifting baseline. And that we think has been a bottleneck with climate change for a long period of time. My research is trying to explain why this process is happening, how this process is unfolding. And one of the reasons I would like to argue is that it's happening because while we might read, you know, with climate change, you know, there are two sides of climate change that's happening. On one hand, we see
a huge amount of climate disasters happening all over the planet, all over the world. We see that in the news a lot. For example, there were wildfires in LA this year. There were various problematic flooding that happened last year in Texas. Just now we saw hurricanes happening in Jamaica. But on the other hand, in our daily experiences, in our lived day-to-day experiences, climate change is only happening very gradually and very slowly. And when things are happening very slowly and gradually in our perception, we are slowly, but surely adapting to the small changes that are happening in our day-to-day lives. And when that is happening, that is the premise. Our minds are not well equipped to deal with very slow and gradually changing things. So in the long run, when things are slowly changing, let's say things are very slowly changing for 10 years, 20 years, we suddenly look back from 20 years, what things used to be 20 years ago or 50 years ago, things seem very dramatic. Things have changed quite a lot. But in our perception, they were changing so slowly that it doesn't matter at all. So we are, like, in an analogy speaking, we are the boiling frog. Although, I mean, we know that, you know, frogs do jump out of the boiling water eventually. But that, I think, is the basis of shifting baselines, where even though it might seem that climate extremes are getting worse and worse throughout the world, but in our lived experiences, it's happening so slowly that it becomes a background noise.
Well, this adaptation to a new reality happens on two different planes. I mean, the first school shootings in the United States were shocking. They were strange. Now they're common. Right. Humans can adapt to declines of situations like that, but we can also adapt to success. Now, millions of people accept maximum consumption of goods as a goal. Is normalization of success sometimes dangerous too?
100%. So if you look at, to me, there are two sides of climate change, right? One, on the one hand, we are seeing, as you know, the analogy that you raise with gun violence, like we are seeing our society is adapting to worsening climate quite a lot over a period of time, right? Right. Like, so first time we see wildfires, it is very shocking. But the next year, we get adapted to two wildfires a summer or three wildfires a summer. It becomes a new normal. We become adapted to it, right? On the other hand, the other aspect that is very closely tied to climate change is the massive increase in consumption that we have seen in the past 50 years to 100 years. Half the carbon ever emitted by the entire of humanity has just happened in the last 30 years. Right? So that to me is a very insane number. And if you look at whether or not human happiness has increased at that level in the last 30, 50 years, we will see that there has been bumps in human happiness. We have slightly risen in happiness over a period of time because of economic growth and because of more rights and a lot of civil movements. That has been a great thing. But is the dramatic, absolute dramatic rise of consumption correlated dramatically, like at the level that has our happiness level risen to the level that we've increased our consumption? It has not. So to me, in the end, this huge amount of consumption that we've been doing is the part of the trap as well, right? So that just because we become used to a standard of living, we only accept that higher standard of living as a new normal. So there is this phrase, if I'm trying to remember correctly, it's called yesterday's luxuries are today's necessities. Right, so they become, yesterday's luxuries become the new necessity for the next generation or for ourselves over a period of time, which forces more consumption over the next cycle without an increase or a remarkable increase in our human happiness level. So it does beg the question to ask us that, why are we consuming so much? Is it worth the level of consumption that we're doing? Or is it just a kind of a rat race or a hedonic treadmill that we are trapped onto a cycle of ever-increasing consumption?
Just recently, I spoke with UK climate researcher Susanna Fisher about maladaptation, and you studied that as well? And what did you find about maladaptation? Why do we sometimes make the mistakes of taking the wrong path to the right challenge?
It does make sense for an intelligent being to not respond to it at the urgency that it requires. Because it is changing in their perception, because of the limited memory window that we have, in our perception, climate change is only happening very slowly. And the shifting baseline is also an example of that, right? Where, like, I forget what happened 50 years ago, or societies collectively forget what happened 20 years ago, because we don't have infinite memory. Or, you know, people die, you know, and then the next generation comes in, and the next generation is adapted to five wildfires a year. and that's the new normal. So what is looking like maladaptation, to me, is a fundamental feature of the human mind, where we have limited memories, we have limited computational abilities, we have limited bandwidth, we have limited time. And from that perspective, the properties of climate change are such that it doesn't appear as the big problem that it needs to be. If we had more memory, if we had time, if there was more communication between intergenerations, where, like, you know, you hear more stories from your grandparents about how things used to be back in their days, and if they also remember it very accurately, if you remember that, you know, your local town used to have a much more richer winter tradition, or you used to have much more biodiversity in the past, your backyards are filled with more birds in the past. If you had all of those memories, and if you can do that projection accurately about the future also, then we would be treating climate change very differently. That's my hypothesis, and that's my argument.
So many climate presentations begin with charts showing carbon dioxide or heat rising gradually from about 1900 until today. You call that continuous data, but something else motivates people more. What is binary climate data? With examples, please.
The example that you just said right now, where you said here in Canada, we used to have ice rinks in our backyard where people could play hockey, and now we don't have that anymore. That is binary data. That is a data about yes and no, right? We used to have something, now we don't have something. So when we talk about climate change and climate change communication, we usually focus on things like temperature and carbon, right? And it's got to be rising over a period of time, or it's risen a lot, and this is really bad. And this is a very abstract thing. It's going to be hot. There's more carbon in the air, in the atmosphere. This is very bad, but it's still very abstract. But when you talk about this ice thing, when you talk about the hockey thing, I've never been to the parts of Canada that you're in, but I could immediately visualize this. I could immediately imagine this, and it feels visceral and it feels real to me. And I can feel a kind of a loss. And I think, for better or worse, climate change is already doing this to our own backyards. Climate change is already doing that to ourselves, and it's already affecting our personal lives in these yes and no manners. And this is what something I think is very important for people to connect the dots with. And that's very important for communication to focus upon. That if it's actually an existential, it's actually a very big urgent problem, then people need to understand that this is a big urgent problem. And this is a way to actually talk about it. And that's something, thank you for pointing that out, that's something that we found in our experiments too, that when we show people, you know, temperature data or carbon data or something like that versus when we show lake freeze data, like lake used to freeze versus it doesn't freeze, even when we match the underlying trend, even when the temperature is changing at the same rate at which the lake has stopped freezing over a period of time, people feel climate change is more impactful, or like climate change is more of a problem when they look at lake freeze data compared to temperature data.
Radio EcoShock.
So to learn anything about this, we first need to open a doorway into our minds. And I know you've looked into this. What stimulates curiosity? How does that work?
So curiosity, to me, is stimulated by three aspects. Well, very broadly speaking, the cognitive aspects of curiosity. One is your perception of what you know about the world. If I think, you know, if given something, you think that you know everything about it already, then you don't need to worry about it because you already know everything about it, so you don't need to be curious to learn about it. And so the interesting case comes in when you think you know nothing about it or when you know something about it. We will return back to what happens when you know nothing about it. But when you know something about it, curiosity is very, very stimulated, and curiosity spiked quite a lot when you know something about it because you don't fully know about it. You want to close that information gap. You want to close that knowledge gap. So our minds are motivated to learn something about it. I'll return to about the case when you know nothing about it in just a second. The other aspect that controls the curiosity is what's called, you know, what I would like to call is like your perception of the difficulty of learning something. So if you think something is going to be very difficult to learn, then you're not going to spend a lot of time trying to learn about it because it's going to take a long time for you to learn about it. It's going to take too much effort. That does not excite you. If something is going to take you very little time to learn, then you're going to be curious about it because it's very easy to close that information and you know something about it, you know something not about it, then you're going to be motivated to learn about it. But when it's too easy to learn, then it will also become boring over a period of time. You will move on to the next thing. And so the optimal curiosity is usually piked when it's moderately difficult because that's the thing that keeps you moderately engaged in it over a period of time. And so this, by the way, interacts a lot with the knowledge part that I was talking about. When you know, remember when I said, when you don't know anything about something. When you don't know anything about something and you find out that it's very hard to learn, you won't be motivated to learn it. So you won't be motivated to learn something about rocket science or how quantum physics works. Because let's say you don't know anything about it, you think that it's going to be really hard to learn, so you're not going to spend time learning about it. And the final thing, which seems counterintuitive to the definition or colloquial way that we think about curiosity, what we found is your perception of usefulness of learning about something. If you think that something is going to be not useful at all, then your curiosity will go down a little bit. Not saying it will be completely extinguished, but it will definitely go down a little bit. But if you think that something is going to be very useful to you in the future, then you might be more curious to learn something about it. So the holy grail of curiosity comes in if you think something is going to be useful to you and you know something about it and you think it's going to be slightly, moderately difficult to learn. That is the holy grail of curiosity. But now you might ask, then why are we curious to watch TikTok videos, or why are we curious to watch, some detective shows or some shows that seemingly have no usefulness to it? And then that comes back to the ease of learning and when you know nothing about something. So even if you think something is going to be not very useful towards you, it might be slightly useful in some social context or something like that. So your curiosity might be lower, but you can still be motivated to learn about it because it is so cognitively not effortful. Like, it doesn't take you much cognitive effort to watch a TikTok video. You don't know something about it. It might be slightly stimulating, and it's very easy to learn. And then once you scroll through one TikTok video, you will be, instead of now opening up a book and reading something that you might have some curiosity, but it still takes so much cognitive effort to do it, the other thing is going to be more tempting, just watching one more TikTok video, for which you know not something about, and it's very easy to learn. So the way that curiosity ends up working in this long run is that it's always a competition between different kind of stuff that exists in the world and what we are going to pay attention to resolving our curiosity.
As you know, there is some controversy about whether computational models can really explain the depth and complexity of human cognition. Rajit, how do you work around those uncertainties?
For me, I treat computational models as an analogy. I don't treat my computational modeling work that I do as a way to model the human mind, and this is exactly how the human mind works. That's not the way I treat it. I treat my computational models as just an analogy. Like, I'm building a computational model of hedonic treadmill, or I'm building a computational model of how we detect changes in the environment and like how we respond to continuous data versus binary data. And then I find something interesting about the properties of these computational models, and I treat that as an analogy to how the human mind could be responding to certain kinds of data as well.
I loved your project employing AI-generated visuals of car-free U.S. cities. What is the goal there?
And thank you for pointing that out. So the goal over there was oftentimes seemingly good green policies turn out to be very, very controversial, for better or worse. And I'm not saying, this is a good thing, that's a bad thing. There's something about climate policies that always involves certain kinds of trade-offs, because it involves giving up something for something better in the long run. And climate policies across the world, across the globe, across the political climate, usually end up being controversial, right? So our goal over here was, can we help people imagine what it would be like to live in a place that is less car-dependent and more designed for pedestrians and for better walkability? So what we did in this project was we showed people different views of different typical streets in America, which are very car-dominant, and then we showed a revisualization of that same street and a reimagination of that same street, what it would look like if it was less car-dependent, it was more pedestrian-friendly. There will be bigger sidewalks, there will be more greenery, there will be a bit more buses, and it will be more bustling in that. And our goal was just only to ask, given this kind of reimagination or utopian imagination of what public transport has the potential to do for people's lives, would people be more amenable to certain kinds of, these kinds of climate policies and green policies? And we find out, long story short, like, people were more amenable to it. Obviously, people will have restraints and constraints about, whether this policy is actually achievable, whether it will help them achieve this goal. But our goal was over here, this paper was primarily for policymakers. Like, if you have a policy that you think can actually improve people's life meaningfully, then you need to give people kind of an imagination and a visual of how it would improve their lives.
Last summer, you launched a research lab at the Department of Communication at the University of California, Los Angeles. What do you have in the works? What are you working on?
One line of work is continuing to work on normalization. So right now, I would say my lab has made some progress about understanding the boiling frog effect and shifting baseline syndrome within one generation. What I mean by one generation is, like, you know, I've done research about, like, over 10 years or 20 years or my own perception, how we end up normalizing climate change. But one thing that I'm obviously worried about, you know, my binary work showed that how we can get people away from this shock of, you know, things slowly changing versus things that have actually changed quite a lot. But one of the worries that I have is that we will normalize over a period of time more and more increasing climate disasters as new normal also. That's the final form of the shifting baseline syndrome. So I'm now investigating the cognitive foundations of how we adapt to worsening things and even dramatically worsening things over a period of time. That is something I think is a bit underexplored in the field. So that's one big part of the work that I'm working upon. The other part of the work that I'm working upon is how do we design climate policies that are less polarizing. So the past work that I just described about the visualizations aspect was about trying to communicate to people why a certain policy could be useful to them or how it could be useful to them. But I would like to do, I'm trying to do a rethink about how we have historically worked and designed climate policies. Usually the way we have done climate policies is that policies are designed by economists or policymakers or government officials, and there's a lot of work that is then done to convince the public that this policy is going to be good for them, and then maybe doing a bit of revision to that policy based on public feedback. But the work that I'm excited to build upon is trying to understand what does the public actually want in a policy. What's the best compromise climate policy that we could find for a certain state or for a local region, and how do we basically design a policy that tries to capture as many people's preferences as possible? So this policy might not be the, you know, might not be the best policy possible that will reach all the climate goals, but it's a policy that will be more robust to public opinion. We don't want to have policies that we think could be good, but they either don't get passed or when they're passed, they're rolled back. But we want policies that are going to be relatively good, but they are going to be implemented in the long run, and so that we keep on making progress in climate change in the way that we want to make. So those are the two sets of projects that I'm very excited by.
From UCLA, we've been speaking with computational cognitive scientist Ratchit Dubey. You can find links to several papers and the article, The Normalization of Almost Everything, in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Ratchit, thank you for speaking with our listeners today.
Thank you so much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Cosmic Dust.